Welcome to Inside Education. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. The programme's website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of over 140 Inside Education programmes. Educational research should help to improve the process and practice of education. Yet many teachers I know quickly get impatient with research in education because it doesn't readily apply to their situation. Furthermore, we often hear about the gap between theory and practice in education. One researcher who I think manages to do a good job in bridging educational theory and practice is Walter Doyle. To a greater extent than most, Walter Doyle produces research that is typically inspired by, informed by, and relevant to classroom practice. A professor in the Department of Teaching, Learning and Sociocultural Studies at the University of Arizona School of Education, he is interested in topics such as classroom management, classroom tasks and teacher education. A respected researcher in his own right, he is also known for synthesizing and reviewing the research of others. I met up with Walter Doyle on the fringes of the American Educational Research Association's annual meeting this year. He had just given a presentation, and occasionally he refers to that talk and to the talks of some of his co-presenters. Later on this week's programme, we'll hear why teachers can see themselves as task managers and why it is important to think carefully about the work learners do in school. But first, we'll hear about classroom management. This is a topic that Walter Doyle has been thinking about since the 1970s. I asked him what he had learned from thinking and reading about classroom management since that time.
I started out I took my teacher education in a master's program, and my internship was in a high school, and everything was fine because everything was already set up for me in many ways by the other experienced teachers. And then I took a job teaching what we now call middle school. And I couldn't figure out what happened. I was getting rope burns from the struggle we were having over issues of order. And when I stumbled on Jack Koonin's work, I began to go, wow, he's saying a lot here. And Paul Gump, who was a colleague of Jack's, and began to say, yeah, when I watch classrooms, and I used to spend a lot of time watching, I am seeing things going on here, and I'd often ask the cooperating or mentor teachers that were working with the student teachers, you know, what happened, and they'd go, well, you have to like kids, or something very unanalytical. I had a student teacher once say, I did this morning, but after this lesson, I'm not sure I do. I thought that was great. But I began to say, oh, there's something happening. And then I would practice explaining in ways that I understood, and watch to see if the expert would nod. And I kind of learned how to talk about classrooms, and then with Jack and Paul's work, began to develop that idea of these ecologies, these environments that teachers are constructing and managing. And so then I went to the literatures in a whole bunch of other fields and tried to draw from that work.
What fields do you mean?
Fields like cognitive anthropology, where people try to tell what they do and how they organize their life and how things work. Listening to teachers talk, what are they trying to tell me? And so, it's hard to say what I've learned. I've written about it, in some review articles. But the most important thing for me was that this is you're creating classroom systems. It isn't just about punishment. It isn't just about what Jack used to call desist. It's not just about stopping misbehavior when it occurs. It's about seeing where it's going to happen. When's it going to come up? And listening to teachers I had once a great opportunity of a teacher who sat next to me while the student teacher was teaching the class and did a running commentary. She needs to move over here. Oops, she better watch out for. She was telling me her classroom knowledge and the things that she was using to manage these systems. I thought, I got to figure out how to write about that. I've got to figure out how to tell those those frameworks because they're really powerful. At the same time, I do teacher ed, and teaching those frameworks is really, really hard because they don't know what I'm talking about. They want to know, if a kid does this, what do I do? And I almost want to tell them, do something. React. And react soon. But that's not your problem. Your problem isn't stopping the kid who's misbehaving. I once watched a wonderful teacher. And she walked into class one day, and she said, George, move over here. And George went, oh, so why? And I asked her after, what were you doing? And she said, George, I couldn't see George. He was sitting behind the largest kid in class, and I needed to see George. And it was this, it took her about a second and a half to get George in place where she could see him. Had she not done that, 10 minutes into that lesson, I knew George. I'd seen him in other classes. And there could have been a huge explosion. And she just avoided it. And you know, it was very difficult for the student teacher to see what she was doing. It looked so easy. And they just thought you could just step up and do whatever you wanted to do. And she had this enormously complex visual image of the class and what she had to be able to see in order to go on with the lessons. And her lessons went just like clockwork. But it wasn't an accident, and it wasn't the quality of the students, and it was she understood timing and rhythms and what to see when and who to see first. And it was just an amazingly rich array of skills she was showing that were very hard to unpack for the novices.
And how can novices then learn those kind of skills or strategies in order to be able to even begin to handle classroom management like that?
Well, it's the 10,000 hours, isn't it, that experts need, that we that Malcolm Gladwell popularized, but I think that's true. Deborah Ball mentioned that she didn't, you know, that this myth that you can only learn teaching from practicing teaching. She may be able to speed it up, but I don't think you're going to speed it up very much. I think you just have to do it and do it over and over again.
And you've been writing about this and thinking about this since at least the 1970s. And I know certainly Ireland, and I'm sure the United States, is a different country now than it was in the 1970s in terms of children's attitudes and parents' expectations and all the other things that have changed. Have the basic principles of classroom management stayed the same, or have they changed in all the time you've been thinking about them?
I think they've stayed pretty much the same. You know, they manifest themselves differently. But I think the processes are the same. This need to have a vector and a rhythm and a sense of purpose and something on the floor for the students to do. These are all there. They manifest themselves differently. And so you have to react differently in the ways students use to communicate their respect or disapproval or whatever do modify. And that's the cross-cultural issues that we face in particularly in the United States classrooms, where there's an enormous diversity of social practices on the floor. Knowing how students communicate is really difficult. But it's, I think, the fundamentals are still the same. What's happened is the pressure on teachers to be responsible for everything. That it's only, I mean, when I started in the business, the question was a response to James Coleman's famous DSEG study, in which he said teachers don't make a difference. And all these people, Jerry Brophy and Tom Good, and all these people saying, no, we're going to prove that teachers make a difference. And somehow we overstated it. Now we're faced with the notion that only teachers make a difference. And I go, wait a minute, no, something, we somehow went too far with that, and that we're masking a lot of other health, well, in our country particularly, healthcare and poverty issues that are being ignored. But I think the fundamentals of management are the same. Maybe more difficult to learn in certain settings how to do those things.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programs can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. My guest today is Walter Doyle. In addition to classroom management, Walter Doyle has done some pioneering research in looking seriously at what learners are asked to do in classrooms. He calls it academic work. He explained to me the personal experience he had in observing an English lesson that prompted his interest in what exactly students do when they are working in class.
That was another personal experience of watching a student teacher who announced at the beginning it was an 11th grade high school English class, and she announced that today there was a written on the sideboard of the chalkboard was written the three characteristics of naturalist writers, and she said today we're going to discuss the story by Stephen Crane called The Open Boat, which had been in the curriculum for centuries. And so she said we're going to see how it illustrates these principles of naturalist writing. And I thought that's an interesting analytical task. That's fascinating. And so she began the discussion with about six students in the room, what we used to call the action zone. It was very alive in that class. And so it's about 5 minutes into the lesson, she said, now we see how characteristic one is illustrated. And a hand went up in the sort of smoky, dark regions of the class, and a student said, is this going to be on the test? And the student teacher was brilliant. She said, it would be well if you knew this, which I thought was a wonderful answer. Had she said no, they would have all gone to sleep. Had she said yes for sure and then forgot to put it on the test, she could get in trouble. You know, I studied what you told me to study. So she by saying that, the students began to pull out pencils and paper and writing things down. But I noticed they were all... what they were writing down was the three characteristics of naturalist writers. And they were writing also when she said, now we see how characteristic two is illustrated, they all would write that down. I thought, wait a minute, the students seem to be thinking that what they're going to have to do tomorrow is remember these three characteristics and the examples the teacher singled out. But that wasn't what I interpreted she wanted them to do in the beginning. She wanted them to analyze the story. And I thought, what if she'd have come in the next day and said, here's a story you've never seen. Is it naturalist writing or not? And this counts one-third of your grade. I think they would have rebelled. That's not fair. You know. And I got intrigued by it. I was just fascinated by that. What's going on here? And I began to get interested in task as a... how do we frame those things? And that's when I began to go back to the literature and see, what are tasks like? And some of the ethnography people, like Fred Erickson and others, would use task. And the sociolinguistics people talked about tasks. And I thought, task is a really interesting idea. And then the early cognitive information processing people would talk about the nature of the tasks. Some of the tasks were a little strange, the missionaries and cannibals and things like this, but nonetheless the task was framing cognition, and that's when I began to study classroom tasks, particularly complex tasks like writing tasks, which are not formulaic, and how do those get accomplished in classrooms. And so that's when I got very, very excited about that kind of work, and it got picked up by the people in mathematics in particular, talk about the math task framework. Pat Herbst at the University of Michigan has done a lot of work on very complex tasks and what their trajectories are and their life histories. So I think it's a really powerful idea. You can't talk about teaching effects unless you pick up the task, because just watching the behavior doesn't tell you what the students are having to think about in that setting. So I think it's a really powerful framework.
And among the tasks you talked about are memory tasks, procedural or routine tasks, comprehension or understanding tasks, and opinion tasks. Why do teachers need to attend to those kinds of tasks when they're thinking about work that they're going to set for their students?
Well, I think that in our all of the work I've done in classrooms is you don't see very many understanding tasks. Although if you ask the teachers, what's your goal here? We want them to understand this stuff. But they're very unstable because to create the conditions in which students have to use understanding in order to get the work done, you have to have an ambiguous product. Because if the product is not ambiguous, they can copy it down or they can, you know, it's just too explicit. So you have to mess with explicitness. And they're often uncomfortable doing that. The students are often uncomfortable doing that. They will say, tell me what you want. You know, how many pages or how many, you know, what's the answer? And so they become, there's a lot of pressure on teachers then to do that. But if you really believe in understanding, and that's certainly what most of the models coming out of, particularly math and science, in this teaching for understanding and ambitious teaching, there's a number of labels for this. They're really talking about tasks in which the students have to go beyond the information given, have to invent or somehow construct novel answers. And in classrooms, that's difficult. The conditions of the classroom are such that it's easy for that to drop off the table and proceduralize everything, provide an answer. In one of the studies that Kathy Carter and I were involved in, the teacher was trying to get the students to write a strong ending to a persuasive essay, and she had them do it several times, and she'd hand them back and say, no, I don't have a strong ending yet. And one day a student came up to her and said, is this a strong ending? And the teacher said, no, look. And the teacher revised the sentence. And when we looked at the student's work, everybody in that region of the class had exactly the same sentence because it was the strong ending, even though it didn't fit their essay. And you began to realize, yeah, they found the answer. And out of frustration, the teacher gave them the answer. And they now, what you essentially did is bypass the task. And that happens more often than not. And to do that, you really have to be skilled. You have to know what to look for. You have to be willing to tolerate a lot of pressure from students to change that. But I think if we really are serious, and most of us are, I think, most teachers say, yeah, I want them to understand. I want them to really understand this stuff. It's one of our highest curricular goals. It's just not easy to accomplish in classrooms.
And it's not just selecting the task, but it's managing the task and not reducing the demand of it.
That's right. Yeah, over time they'll float away and drift away. It is all in management. It's not just setting it up. It's keeping it on the floor and moving it. We found in an architecture design class, studio class, when they were in the studio, the architecture instructors told us what they do mostly is open and close tasks. If it gets too narrow, they're not going to learn anything, so we try to urge them to open it up. If it gets too broad, they'll never accomplish it, so we help them close it. But they saw themselves as task managers in that sense, and I think that teachers are task managers. Not only the first year you do it, but the second year and third year, because you already know how it's going to go, you can start routinizing it without even thinking about it. So that over time, curriculums often fade out because the teachers go, oh, well, this is how it's going to go. And as soon as they see evidence that it's going that way, they sort of close it down and say. So it takes a constant vigilance, I think, to keep these on the floor and to make sure the students are engaged in them.
And it's very important for teachers as well to be able to select tasks and to have tasks available to them. And I'm thinking here particularly of the quality of curriculum materials and textbooks that are available to teachers. Or where do you find that teachers can source the kinds of tasks that are helpful for use with students?
innovative materials often have a good frame, what I call a frame narrative. They talk a lot about the theory behind it and the importance of the approach and all this sort of thing. But the task narratives are very thin to say, how do you actually do this? And I think often innovators don't quite think that far through. So teachers have to do a lot of invention. And it's not easy to get access to these things. It really takes a, I think that's the key to really inventive teaching, is this curricular framing. I see curriculum as a teaching process, or teaching as a curriculum process. I think they're really close together, because you're constantly making decisions about what counts as an adequate answer, or as an interesting question, as productive time. And so you're shaping curriculum constantly. And we don't do that very much in teacher ed. We don't talk about that. I think Deborah Ball's work and Pam Grossman's work are really beginning to help us think about talking about the curriculum while you're teaching, thinking about the curriculum while you're teaching. But I think that's one of the big failures of most materials that teachers get, is that they don't really tell you how to do that. They try to convince you to do it, but they don't tell you precisely how that gets done. And you get, Fred proposed today, the teapot with the handle on the same side as the spout. Many of them are like that. They inspire, but getting down to that level of saying, how do I do that, and what are the timing and rhythms that I have to think about? It's a real gap in our teacher preparation. We don't talk much about curriculum as a classroom event. And in many of the materials they get, the best kinds of tasks they're going to end up with are the tasks that involve filling in pages and blanks. And you get a lot of worksheet sorts of things, which then don't require an awful lot of thinking, just recognition and recall. That's the most plentiful available task. But inventing good tasks is hard.
Yeah. Walter, you spend your time teaching and researching. How do you balance those two dimensions of your work?
Oh, that's always hard. Yeah, we get hired to teach, and we get rewarded for doing research. It's tough. Yeah, I've been very fortunate, I think. I've been able to combine some of my work with student teachers to help inspire how I think about things. And I've got some good, smart colleagues that have helped do that kind of work. That's a constant struggle. It really is to be able to do that.
And how do you go about your research?
Well, I'm a structuralist first. I think in structures. I see structures all over the place. And I love to do sort of qualitative, I like to see things and I like to write them down, and I like to reflect on that a lot, and lift it off the particulars and try to do this. It's very labor-intensive kind of work. So it takes a lot of time. I'm also probably more known in the field as a synthesizer reviewer than I am as an empiricist. I don't publish a lot of strictly empirical work. I often try to synthesize. I think one of the things I do well, and I'm not sure why I fell on this, is to say, wow, I see patterns across a whole bunch of things. Let me put these all together. And if you've read some of those papers, you see how I kind of, where did I get that stuff? But I do an awful lot of that kind of large conceptual pieces easier. But that's not easy. I mean, it's hard work, but I enjoy it. I enjoy handbook chapters are where I do much of my work. Yeah.
And finally, if you were to look into the future, where do you see teacher education going, and how do you look at it, I suppose, as it is today, but where do you see the priorities in the coming decade or longer?
Well, I think we've thanks to the work that we saw today, that Pam Grossman's work and Deborah Ball's work and others. I think it's going to become more clinical. I think it's going to be closer to practice. I think we've gotten around this notion that it's easy to teach and you can just send somebody in there with a little crash course and they'll be able to do it. They'll take it much more seriously, and that the induction into the profession is going to be a much more elongated sort of process. But certainly I think the direction that the session this morning was talking about, the focus on practice and the conditions of practice, is where we're going. I think somehow public policy is not going that way. Public policy seems to think it's very simple, and it's just a matter of evaluating them and they'll do it right. I think we're discovering that's not working. That we've had years of that sort of assessment approach to it, and if it was working, we wouldn't have the same problems we have. So I think we're taking it more seriously and much more clinically and much more in the sort of vein that we heard today, to look at these high leverage practices, to think about the conditions it takes to learn these practices and to the sense making processes that surround this. It's not an easy thing to do. I don't want to overstate that. I mean, it's not impossible. People do it all the time, and some are quite brilliant at it. But it is a process that's going to take 3 or 4 years to be a really good teacher, consistently good with a variety of students. And I'm hoping, and David Berliner gave a paper the other day about this, is the teacher the only responsible agent in education? And it was a very well-done paper. But I think we're also going to begin to recognize that the real issues of education are the issues of healthcare and poverty and employment and all of the things that go around the kinds of family conditions and social conditions that children live in, and that to say that those problems can be solved somehow by firing teachers is, I think, a very mistaken, despite its popularity in the policy arena these days.
Although in his final point, Walter Doyle was speaking about the US context, I think that Irish listeners can relate what he says pretty well to Ireland too. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programs on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email us at InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Thanks to my guest, Walter Doyle. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.